Maybe it was what they were after. Sometimes Weil wondered whether the torture might cause the very disloyalty the Inquisition was there to stop, but he kept that notion very much to himself. Takes courage to lead a charge, but you've got people behind you there. Takes a different and rarer kind to stand up all alone and say, "I don't like the way we do things," especially to a set of torturers. Weil didn't have either kind of courage. So he just did as he was told and tried not to think about it, and wondered what it would be like to have a job you believed in. Ferring didn't have that same problem. He liked the work. You could see it in those blue, blue eyes of his. He grinned over at the tattooed old man now and said, "Dad, he'll be taking a burn in that well by the time he gets back to Sterickland." The prisoner just sat and watched, blue-painted ribs shifting with his crackly breathing. "Lot of nights between here and there. Lot of burnings, maybe. Yes, indeedy. Reckon he'll be good and talkative by—" "I already suggested you shut up," said Boulder. "Now I'm thinking of making it an instruction. What are you—" There was a knock at the door. Three quick knocks, in fact. The practicals looked at each other, eyebrows up. Lawson, back with more questions? Once Lawson had a question in mind, he wasn't a man to wait for an answer. "You're going to get that?" Pouth asked Ferring. "Why would I?" "You're closest. You're shortest. What's that got to fucking do with anything?" "It amuses me." "Maybe my knife up your ass will amuse me." And Pouth slipped his knife out of his sleeve, blade appearing as if by magic. He loved to do that, bloody show-off. "Will you two infants please shut up?" Boulder chucked down his cards, levered his bulk from his chair, and slapped Pouth's knife aside. "I came out here to get a break from my bloody children, not to mind three more." Weil rearranged his cards again, wondering if there was some way he could win. One win, was that too much to ask? But such a rotten hand. His father had always said, "There are no rotten hands, only rotten players." But Weil believed otherwise. Another insistent knocking. "All right, I'm coming," snapped Boulder, dragging back the bolts. "It's not as if—" There was a clatter, and Weil looked up to see Boulder lurching against the wall, looking quite put out, and someone barging past. Seemed a bit strong, even if they'd taken a while to answer the door. Boulder obviously agreed because he opened his mouth to complain, then looked surprised when he gurgled blood everywhere instead. That was when Weil noticed there was a knife handle sticking from his fat throat. He dropped his cards. "Hey," said Ferring, trying to get up, but his boots were tangled with the table. It wasn't Lawson who'd been knocking, it was the big Northman, the one with all the scars. He took a stride into the room, teeth bared, and crunch, left a knife buried in Ferring's face to the crosspiece, his nose flattened under it and blood welling, and Ferring wheezed and arched back and kicked the table over, cards and coins flying. Weil stumbled up, the Northman turning to look at him, blood dotting his face and pulling another knife from inside his coat, and— "Stop!" hissed Pouth. "Or I kill him." Somehow he'd got to the prisoner, kneeling behind the chair he was roped to, knife blade pressed against his neck. Always been a quick thinker, Pouth. Good thing someone was. Boulder had slid to the floor, was making a honking sound and drooling blood into a widening pool. Weil realized he was holding his breath and took a great gasp. The scarred Northman looked from Weil to Pouth and back, lifted his chin slightly, then gently lowered his blade. "Get out!" snapped Pouth, and he tangled his fingers in the prisoner's grey hair and pulled his head back, tickling his stubbled neck with the point of his knife. "I'll see to this!" Weil circled the Northman, his knees all shaky, pushing aside one of the leather curtains that divided up the forts downstairs, trying to keep as safe a distance as possible. He slithered in Boulder's blood and nearly went right over, then dived out of the open door and was running. "Help!" he screeched. "Help!" One of the mercenaries lowered a bottle and stared at him cross-eyed. "What?" The celebrations were still half-heartedly dragging on, women laughing and men singing and shouting and rolling in a stupor, none of them enjoying it, but going through the motions anyway, like a corpse that can't stop twitching, all garishly lit by the sizzling bonfire. Wilde slid over in the mud, staggered up, dragging down his mask so he could shout louder.
"Help! The Northman! The prisoner!"
Someone was pointing at him and laughing, and someone shouted at him to shut up, and someone was sick all over the side of a tent, and Wilde stared about for anyone who might exert some control over this shambles, and suddenly felt somebody clutch at his arm.
"What are you jabbering about?"
None other than General Koska, dewy eyes gleaming with the firelight, lady's white powder smeared across one hollow, rash-speckled cheek.
"The Northman!"
squealed Wilde, grabbing the Captain General by his stained shirt.
"Lum! He killed Balder and Ferring!"
He pointed a trembling finger towards the fort.
"In there!"
To give him his due, Koska needed no convincing.
"Enemies in the camp!"
he roared, flinging his empty bottle away.
"Surround the fort! You, cover the door. Make sure no one leaves. Dimbik, get men around the back. You, put that woman down. Arm yourselves, you wretches!"
Some snapped to obey. Two found bows and pointed them uncertainly towards the door. One accidentally shot an arrow into the fire. Others stared baffled, or continued with their revelry, or stood grinning, imagining that this was some elaborate joke.
"What the hell happened?"
Lawson, black coat flapping open over his nightshirt, hair wild about his head.
"It would appear our friend Lamb attempted a rescue of your prisoner," said Koska. "Get away from that door, you idiots! Do you think this is a joke?"
"Rescue?"
muttered Swarbrick, eyebrows raised and eyeglasses skewed, evidently having recently crawled from his bed.
"Rescue?"
snapped Lawson, grabbing Wilde by the collar.
"Balth took the prisoner. Prisoner. He seen to it."
A figure lurched from the fort's open door, took a few lazy steps, eyes wide above his mask, hands clasped to his chest. Pouth. He pitched on his face, blood turning the snow around him pink.
"You were saying?"
snapped Koska. A woman shrieked, stumbled back with a hand over her mouth. Men started to drag themselves from tents and shacks, bleary-eyed, pulling on clothes and bits of armor, fumbling with weapons, breath smoking in the cold.
"Get more bows up here!"
roared Koska, clawing at his blistered neck with his fingernails.
"I want a pincushion of anything that shows itself! Clear the bloody civilians away!"
Lawson was hissing in Wilde's face.
"Is Conthus still alive?"
"I think so. He was when I...
"Cravenly fled? Pull your mask up, dammit, you're a disgrace!"
Probably the Inquisitor was right, and Wilde was a disgraceful practical. He felt strangely proud of that possibility.
"Can you hear me, Master Lamb?"
called Koska, as Sergeant Friendly helped him into his gilded, rusted breastplate, a combination of pomp and decay that rather summed up the man.
"Aye,"
came the Northman's voice from the black doorway of the fort. The closest thing to silence had settled over the camp since the mercenaries returned in triumph the previous day.
"I am so pleased you have graced us with your presence again."
The Captain General waved half-dressed bowmen into the shadows around the shacks.
"I wish you'd sent word of your coming, though. We could have prepared a more suitable reception."
"Thought I'd surprise you."
"We appreciate the gesture, but I should say I have some 150 fighting men out here."
Koska took in the wobbling bows, dewy eyes, and bilious faces of his company.
"Several of them are very drunk, but still. Long-established admirer though I am of lost causes, I really don't see the happy ending for you."
"I've never been much for happy endings,"
came Lamb's growl. Wilde didn't know how a man could sound so steady under these circumstances.
"Nor me, but perhaps we can engineer one between us."
With a couple of gestures, Koska sent more men scurrying down either side of the fort and ordered a fresh bottle.
Now, why don't you two put your weapons down and come out, and we can all discuss this like civilized men?
Never been much for civilization either, called Lamb. Reckon you'll have to come to me.
Bloody Norseman,
muttered Koska, ripping the cork from his latest bottle and flinging it away.
Dimbik, are any of your men not drunk?
You wanted them as drunk as possible, said the captain,
who had got himself tangled with his bedraggled sash as he tried to pull it on.
Now I need them sober.
A few who were on guard, perhaps.
Send them in.
And we want Conthus alive, barked Lawson.
Dimbik bowed.
We will do our best, Inquisitor.
But there can be no promises.
Koska took a long swallow from his bottle without taking his eyes from the house.
We'll make that northern bastard regret coming back.
You shouldn't have come back, grunted Savion as he loaded the flatbow. Lamb edged the door open to peer through. Regretting it already. A thud, splinters, and the bright point of a bolt showed between the planks. Lamb jerked his head back and kicked the door wobbling shut.
Hasn't quite gone the way I'd hoped. You could say that about most things in life.
In my life, no doubt. Lamb took hold of the knife in the practical's neck and ripped it free, wiped it on the front of the dead man's black jacket, and tossed it to Savion. He snatched it out of the air and slid it into his belt.
You can never have too many knives, said Lamb. It's the rule to live by.
Or die by, said Lamb as he tossed over another.
You need a shirt?
Savion stretched out his arms and watched the tattoos move. The words he'd tried to live his life by.
What's the point in getting them if you don't show them off? I've been covering them up too long.
Man's gotta be what he is, I reckon. Savion nodded.
Wish we'd met 30 years ago.
No, you don't. I was a mad fucker then.
And now?
Lamb stuck a dagger into the tabletop.
Thought I'd learned something.
He thumped another into the doorframe.
But here I am, handing out knives. You pick a path, don't you?
Savion started drawing the string on the other flatbow.
And you think it's just for tomorrow? Then 30 years on, you look back and see you picked your path for life. If you'd known it then, you'd maybe have thought more carefully.
Maybe.
Being honest, I've never been much for thinking carefully.
Savion finally fumbled the string back, glancing at the word freedom tattooed around his wrist like a bracelet.
Always thought I'd die fighting for the cause.
You will, said Lamb, still busy scattering weapons around the room.
The cause of saving my fat old ass.
It's a noble calling.
Savion slipped a bolt into place.
Reckon I'll get upstairs.
Reckon you'd better. Lamb drew the sword he'd taken from Werdenur, long and dull with that silver letter glinting.
We ain't got all night. You'll be all right down here.
Might be best if you just stay up there. That mad fucker from 30 years ago, sometimes he comes visiting.
Then I'll leave the two of you to it. You shouldn't have come back.
Savion held out his hand.
But I'm glad you did. Wouldn't have missed it.
Lamb took a grip on Savion's hand and gave it a squeeze, and they looked each other in the eye. Seemed in that moment they had as good an understanding between them as if they had met 30 years ago. But the time for friendship was over. Savion had always put more effort into his enemies, and there was no shortage outside. He turned and took the stairs 3 at a time, up into the garret, a flatbow in each hand and the bolts over his shoulder. 4 windows, 2 to the front, 2 to the back. Straw pallets around the walls, and a low table with a lit lamp, and in its flickering pool of light, a hunting bow and a quiver of arrows. And a spiked mace, too, metal gleaming. One handy thing about mercenaries, they leave weapons lying about wherever they go. He slipped in a crouch to the front, propped one of the flatbows carefully under the left-hand window, and then scurried over to the right with the other, hooking the shutters open and peering out. There was a fair bit of chaos underway outside, lit by the great bonfire, sparks whirling, folk hurrying this way and that on the far side. Seemed some of those who'd come to get rich on the company's scraps hadn't reckoned on getting stuck in the middle of a fight. The corpse of one of the practicals was stretched out near the door, but Savion shed no tears for him. He'd cried easily as a child, but his eyes had good and dried up down the years. They'd had to. With what he'd seen, and what he'd done, too, there wouldn't have been enough salt water in the world. He saw archers squatting near the shacks, bows trained towards the fort, made a quick note of the positions, of the angles, of the distances. Then he saw men hurrying forward, axes at the ready. He snatched the lamp off the table and tossed it spinning through the dark, saw it shatter on the thatch roof of one of the shacks, streaks of fire shooting hungrily out.
"They're coming for the door!" he shouted.
"How many?"
came Lamb's voice from downstairs.
"Five, maybe."
His eyes flickered across the shadows down there around the bonfire.
"Six."
He worked the stock of the flatbow into his shoulder, settling down still and steady around it, warm and familiar as curling around a lover's back. He wished he'd spent more of his time curled around a lover and less around a flatbow, but he'd picked his path, and here was the next step along it. He twitched the trigger and felt the bow jolt, and one of the axemen took a tottering step sideways and sat down.
"Five!"
shouted Savion, as he slipped away from the window and over to another, setting down the first bow and hefting the second. Heard arrows clatter against the frame behind, one spinning into the darkness of the room. He leveled the bow, caught a black shape against the fire, and felt the shot. A mercenary staggered back and tripped into the flames, and even over the racket, Savion could hear him screaming as he burned. He slid down, back against the wall under the window, saw an arrow flit through above him and shudder into a rafter. He was caught for a moment with a coughing fit, managed to settle it, breath rasping, the burns around his ribs all stinging fresh. Axes at the door now, he could hear them thudding. Had to leave that to Lamb. Only man alive he'd have trusted alone with that task. He heard voices at the back, quiet, but he heard them. Up onto his feet, and he scuttled to the back wall, taking up the hunting bow, no time to buckle the quiver, just wedging it through his belt. He dragged in a long, crackling breath, stifled a cough, and held it, knocked an arrow, drew the string, in one movement poked the limb of the bow behind the shutters, and flicked them open, stood, leaned out, and pushed the air slow through his pursed lips. Men crouched in the shadows against the foot of the back wall. One looked up, eyes wide in his round face, and Savion shot him in his open mouth no more than a stride or two away. He knocked another shaft. An arrow whipped past him, flicking his hair. He drew the bow, calm and steady. He could see light gleam on the archer's arrowhead as he did the same. Shot him in the chest. Drew another arrow. Saw a man running past. Shot him too, and saw him crumple in the snow. Crunching of footsteps as the last of them ran away. Savion took a bead and shot him in the back, and he crawled and whimpered and coughed, and Savion knocked an arrow and shot him a second time, elbowed the shutters closed, and breathed in again. He was caught with a coughing fit and stood shuddering against the wall. He heard a roar downstairs, clash of steel, swearing, crashing, ripping, fighting. He stumbled to the front window again, knocking an arrow, saw two men rushing for the door, shot one in the face, and his legs went from under him. The other skidded to a stop, scuttled off sideways. Arrows were frozen in the firelight, clattering against the front of the building as Savion twisted away. A crack! And the shutters in the back windows swung open, showing a square of night sky. Savion saw a hand on the sill, let fall the bow, and snatched up the mace as he went, swinging it low and fast to miss the rafters, and smashing it into a helmeted head as it showed itself at the window, knocking someone tumbling out into the night. He spun, black shape in the window, as a man slipped into the attic, knife in his teeth. Savion lunged at him, but the haft of the mace glanced off his shoulder, and they grappled and struggled, growling at each other. Savion felt a burning in his gut, fell back against the wall with the man on top of him, reached for the knife at his belt. He saw one half of the mercenary's snarling face lit by firelight, and Savian stabbed at it, ripped it open, black pulp hanging from his head as he stumbled, thrashing blindly around the attic. Savian clawed his way up and fell on him, dragged him down, and stabbed, and coughed, and stabbed, until he stopped moving, knelt on top of him, each cough ripping at the wound in his guts. A bubbling scream had started downstairs, and Savian heard someone squealing,
"No, no, no!"
slobbering, desperate, and he heard Lam growl,
"Yes, you fucker."
Two heavy thuds, then a long silence. Lam gave a kind of groan downstairs, another crash, like he was kicking something over.
"You all right?"
he called, his own voice sounding tight and strange.
"Still breathing,"
came Lam's, even stranger.
"You picked up a scratch."
Savian peeled his palm away from his tattooed stomach, blood there gleaming black. Lot of blood. He wished he could talk to Corlin one last time. Tell her all those things you think but never say, because they're hard to say and there'll be time later. How proud he was of what she'd become. How proud her mother would have been. To carry on the fight. He winced, or maybe to give up the fight, because you only get one life, and do you want to look back on it and see just blood on your hands? But it was too late to tell her anything. He'd picked his path, and here was where it ended. Hadn't been too poor a showing, all told. Some good and some bad, some pride and some shame, like most men. He crawled, coughing, to the front, took up one of the flat bows, and started wrestling at the string with sticky hands. Damn hands, didn't have the strength they used to. He stood up beside the window, men still moving down there, and the shack he threw the lamp on sending up a roaring blaze now, and he bellowed out into the night.
"That the best you can do?"
"Sadly for you,"
came Koska's voice.
"No!"
Something sparked and fizzled in the darkness, and there was a flash like daylight. It was a noise like to the voice of God, as the scriptures say, which leveled the city of the presumptuous Nemai with but a whisper. Joubert peeled his hands from his ears, all things still ringing even so, and squinted towards the fort as the choking smoke began to clear. Much violence had been done to the building. There were holes finger-sized and fist-sized and head-sized rent through the walls of the bottom floor. Half of the top floor had departed the world, splintered planks smouldering in places, three split beams still clinging together at one corner as a reminder of the shape of what had been. There was a creaking, and half the roof fell in, broken shingles clattering to the ground below.
"Impressive," said Braccio.
"The lightning harnessed,"
murmured Joubert, frowning at the pipe of brass. It had nearly leapt from its carriage with the force of the blast, and now sat skewed upon it, smoke still issuing gently from its blackened mouth.
"Such a power should belong only to God."
He felt Koska's hand upon his shoulder.
"And yet he lends it to us to do his work. Take some men in there and find those two old bastards."
"I want Contus alive," snapped Lawson.
"If possible,"
the old man leaned close to whisper.
"But dead is just as good."
Joubert nodded. He had come to a conclusion long years before that God sometimes spoke through the person of Nicomo Koska. An unlikely prophet, some might say. A treacherous, lawless, pink drunkard who had never uttered a word of prayer in all his life. But from the first moment Joubert had seen him in battle, and known he had no fear, he had sensed in him some splinter of the divine. Surely he walked in God's shadow, as the prophet Kalul had walked naked through a rain of arrows, with only his faith to protect him, and emerged untouched, and so forced the emperor of the Gurkish to honour his promise and abase himself before the Almighty.
"You three,"
he said, picking out some of his men with a finger,
"on my signal, go in by the door. You three, come with me."
One of them, a Northman, shook his head with starting eyes round as full moons.
"It's him,"
he whispered.
"Him?"
And in dumbstruck silence he folded the middle finger on his left hand back to leave a gap. Joubert snorted.
"Stay then, fool."
He trotted around the side of the fort, through shadow and deeper shadow, all the same to him, for he carried the light of God within. His men peered up at the building, breathing hard, afraid. They supposed the world was a complicated place full of dangers. Joubert pitied them. The world was simple. The only danger was in resisting God's purpose. Fragments of timber, rubbish, and dust were scattered across the snow behind the building. That and several arrow-shot men, one sitting against the wall and softly gurgling, hand around a shaft through his mouth. Joubert ignored them and quietly scaled the back wall of the fort. He peered into the ruined loft, furniture ripped apart, a mattress spilling straw, no signs of life. He brushed some embers away and pulled himself up. Slid out his sword, metal glinting in the night, fearless, righteous, godly. He eased forward, watching the stairwell black with shadows. He heard a sound from down there, a regular thump, thump, thump. He leaned out at the front of the building and saw his three men clustered below. He hissed at them, and the foremost kicked the door wide and plunged inside. Joubert pointed the other two to the stairwell. He felt something give beneath the sole of his boot as he turned. A hand. He bent and dragged a timber aside.
"Constance is here!"
he shouted.
"Alive?"
came Lawson's shrill bleat.
"Dead."
"Damn it!"
Joubert gathered up what was left of the rebel and rolled it over the ragged remnant of the wall, tumbling down the snow, drifted against the side of the building, to lie broken and bloody. Tattoos ripped with a score of wounds. Joubert thought of the parable of the proud man. God's judgment comes to great and small alike, all equally powerless before the Almighty, inevitable and irreversible, and so it was, so it was. Now there was only the Northman, and however fearsome he might be, God had a sentence already in mind. A scream split the night, a crashing below, roars and groans and a metal scraping, then a strange hacking laugh, another scream. Joubert strode to the stairs. A wailing below now, as horrible as the sinful dead consigned to hell, blubbering off into silence. The point of Joubert's sword showed the way, fearless, righteous. He hesitated, licking at his lips. To feel fear was to be without faith. It is not given to man to understand God's design, only to accept his place in it. And so he clenched his jaw tight and padded down the steps. Black as hell below, light shining in rays of flickering red, orange, yellow, through the holes in the front wall, casting strange shadows. Black as hell, and like hell, it reeked of death. So strong the stench, it seemed a solid thing. Joubert half held his breath as he descended, step by creaking step, eyes adjusting to the darkness by degrees. What revelation? The leather curtains that had divided up the space hung torn, showered, and spotted with black, stirred a little as if by wind, though the space was still. His boot caught something on the bottom step, and he looked down. A severed arm. Frowning, he followed its glistening trail to a black slick, flesh humped and mounded and inhumanly abused, hacked apart and tangled together in unholy configurations, innards dragged out and rearranged and unwound in glistening coils. In the midst stood a table, and upon the table a pile of heads. And as the light shifted from the flames outside, they looked upon Joubert with expressions awfully vacant, madly leering, oddly questioning, angrily accusatory.
"God,"
he said. Joubert had done butchery in the name of the Almighty, and yet he had seen nothing like this, This was written in no scripture, except perhaps in the forbidden seventh of the seven books, sealed within the tabernacle of the great temple in Shaphar, in which were recorded those things that Glustrod brought from hell.
God,
he muttered, and jagged laughter bubbled from the shadows, and the skins flapped and rattled the rings they hung upon. Joubert darted forward, stabbed, cut, slashed at darkness, caught nothing but dangling skin, blade tangled with leather, and he slipped in gore, and fell, and rose, turning, turning, the laughter all around him.
God!
Mumbled Joubert, and he could hardly speak the holy word, for a strange feeling, beginning in his guts and creeping up and down his spine, to set his scalp to tingle and his knees to shake. All the more terrible for being only dimly remembered. A childish recollection lost in darkness. For, as the prophet said, the man who knows fear every day becomes easy in its company. The man who knows not fear, how shall he face this awful stranger?
God!
Whimpered Joubert, stumbling back towards the steps, and suddenly there were arms around him.
Gone,
came a whisper.
But I am here.
Damn it, snarled Lawson again. His long-cherished dream of presenting the infamous Conthus to the Open Council, chained and humbled and plastered with tattoos that might as well have read, "Give Inquisitor Lawson the promotion he has so long deserved," had gone up in smoke. Or down in blood. 13 years minding a penal colony in Angland for this. All the riding, all the sacrifice, all the indignity. In spite of his best efforts, the entire expedition had devolved into a farce, and he had no doubt upon which undeserving head would be heaped the blame. He slapped at his leg in a fury.
I wanted him alive!
So did he, I dare say.
Koska stared narrow-eyed through the haze of smoke towards the ruined fort.
Fate is not always kind to us.
Easy for you to say,
snapped Lawson. To make matters worse, if that were possible, he had lost half his practicals in one night, and that the better half. He frowned over at Weil, still fussing with his mask. How was it possible for a practical to look so pitiably unthreatening? The man positively radiated doubt, enough to plant the seeds of doubt in everyone around him. Lawson had entertained doubts enough over the years, but he did what one was supposed to, and kept them crushed into a tight little packet deep inside, where they could not leak out and poison his purpose. The door slowly creaked open, and Dimbic's archers shifted nervously, flat bows all levelled towards that square of darkness.
Joubert!
Barked Koska.
Joubert! Did you get him? Answer me, damn it!
Something flew out, bounced once with a hollow clonk, and rolled across the snow to rest near the fire.
What is that?
Asked Lawson. Koska worked his mouth.
Joubert's head.
Fate is not always kind, murmured Braccio.
Another head arced from the doorway and bounced into the fire. A third landed on the roof of one of the shacks, rolled down it, and lodged in the gutter. A fourth fell among the archers, and one of them let his bow off as he stumbled away from it, the bolt thudding into a barrel nearby. More heads, and more. Hair flapping, tongues lolling, spinning and dancing and scattering spots of blood. The last head bounced high and rolled an elliptical course around the fire to stop just next to Koska. Lawson was not a man to be put off by a little gore, but even he had to admit to being a little unnerved by this display of mute brutality. Less squeamish, the Captain General stepped forward and angrily kicked the head into the flames.
How many men are those two old bastards killed between them?
Though the old man was no doubt a good deal older than either.
About 20 now,
said Braccio.
We'll fucking run out at this rate.
Koska turned angrily upon Swarbrick, who was frantically scratching away in his notebook.
What the hell are you writing for?
The author looked up, reflected flames dancing in his eyeglasses.
Well, this is rather dramatic.
Do you find?
Swarbrick gestured weakly towards the ruined fort.
He came to the rescue of his friend against impossible odds.
And got him killed. Is not a man who takes on impossible odds generally considered an incorrigible idiot rather than a hero?
The line between the two has always been blurry, murmured Braccio. Swarbrick raised his palms.
I came for a tale to stir the blood.
And I've been unable to oblige you,
snapped Koska.
Is that it? Even my bloody biographer is deserting me. No doubt I'll end up the villain in the book I commissioned, while yonder decapitating madman is celebrated to the rafters. What do you make of this, Temple? Temple, where's that bloody lawyer got to? What about you, Braccio?
The Styrian wiped fresh tears from his weepy eye.
I think the time has come to put an end to the ballad of the nine-fingered Northman.
Finally some sense. Bring up the other tube. I want that excuse for a fort leveled to a stump. I want that meddling fool made mush, do you hear? Someone bring me another bottle. I'm sick of being taken fucking lightly.
Koska slapped Swarbrick's notebook from his hands.
A little respect. Is that too much to ask?
He slapped the biographer to boot, and the man sat down sharply in the snow, one hand to his cheek in surprise.
"What's that noise?"
said Lawson, holding up a palm for silence. A thumping and rumbling spilled from the darkness, rapidly growing louder, and he took a nervous step towards the nearest shack.
"Bloody hell," said Dimbik.
A horse came thundering from the night, eyes wild, and a moment later, dozens more, surging down the slope towards the camp, snow flying, a boiling mass of animals, a flood of horseflesh coming at the gallop. Men flung their weapons down and ran, dived, rolled for any cover. Lawson tripped over his flapping coattail and sprawled in the mud. He heard a whooping and caught a glimpse of Dab Sweet, mounted at the rear of the herd, grinning wildly, lifting his hat in salute as he skirted the camp. Then the horses were among the buildings, and all was a hell of milling, kicking, battering hooves, of screaming, thrashing, rearing beasts, and Lawson flattened himself helplessly against the nearest hovel, clinging with his fingernails to the rough-sawn wood. Something knocked his head, almost sent him down, but he clung on, while a noise like the end of the world broke around him, the very earth trembling under the force of all those maddened animals. He gasped and grunted and squeezed his teeth and eyes together so hard they hurt, splinters and dirt and stones stinging his cheek. Then, suddenly, there was silence. A throbbing, ringing silence. Lawson unpeeled himself from the side of the shack and took a wobbling step or two through the hoof-hammered mud, blinking into the haze of smoke and settling dirt.
"They stampeded the horses," he muttered.
"Do you fucking think so?"
shrieked Koska, tottering from the nearest doorway. The camp was devastated. Several of the tents had ceased to be, the canvas and their contents, both human and material, trampled into the snow. The ruined fort continued to smoulder. Two of the shacks were thoroughly aflame, burning straw fluttering down and leaving small fires everywhere. Bodies were humped between the buildings, trampled men and women in various states of dress. The injured howled or wandered, dazed and bloodied. Here and there, a wounded horse lay, kicking weakly. Lawson touched one hand to his head. His hair was sticky with blood, a trickle tickling his eyebrow.
"Dab fucking Sweet," snarled Koska.
"I did see he had quite a reputation," muttered Swarbrick, fishing his tattered notebook from the dirt.
"Perhaps we should have paid him his share,"
mused Friendly.
You can take it to him now, if you please.
Koska pointed with a clawing finger.
It's in the wagon.
He trailed off into a disbelieving croak. The fortified wagon that had been Superior Pike's gift, the wagon in which the fire tubes had been carried, the wagon in which the dragon people's vast treasure had been safely stowed. The wagon was gone. Beside the fort, there was only a conspicuously empty patch of darkness.
Where is he?
Koska shoved Swarbrick out of the way and ran to where the wagon had stood. Clearly visible in the snowy mud, among the trampled hoofprints, were two deep wheel ruts angling down the slope towards the Imperial Road.
Breccio!
Koska's voice rose higher and higher until it was a demented shriek.
Fire some fucking horses and get after them!
The Styrian stared.
You wanted all the horses corralled together? They're stampeded.
Some must have broken from the herd. Find half a dozen and get after those bastards. Now, now, now!
And he kicked snow at Braccio in a fury and nearly fell over.
Where the hell is Temple?
Friendly looked up from the wagon tracks and raised an eyebrow. Koska closed his hands to trembling fists.
Everyone who can, get ready to move!
Dimbik exchanged a worried look with Lawson.
On foot? All the way to Crease?
We'll gather mounts on the way.
What about the injured?
Those who can walk are welcome. Any who cannot mean greater shares for the rest of us. Now get them moving, you damned idiot.
Yes, sir,
muttered Dimbik, pulling off and sourly flinging away his sash, which, already a ruin, had become thoroughly besmirched with dung when he dived for cover. Friendly nodded towards the fort.
And the Northmen?
Fuck the Northmen,
hissed Koska.
Soak the building with oil and burn it. They've stolen my gold. They've stolen my dreams. Do you understand?
He frowned off down the Imperial Road, the wagon tracks vanishing into the darkness.
I will not be disappointed again.
Lawson resisted the temptation to echo Koska's sentiments that fate is not always kind. Instead, as the mercenaries scrambled over each other in their preparations to leave, he stood looking down at Conthus' forgotten body lying broken beside the fort. What a waste, he muttered, in every conceivable sense. But Inquisitor Lawson had always been a practical man, a man who did not balk at hardship and hard work. He took his disappointment and crushed it down into that little packet, along with his doubts, and turned his thoughts to what could be salvaged. "There will be a price for this, Koska," he muttered at the Captain General's back. "There will be a price." Nowhere fast. Every bolt, bearing, plank and fixing in that monster of a wagon banged, clattered or screeched in an insane cacophony so deafening that Temple could scarcely hear his own squeals of horror. The seat hammered at his arse, bounced him around like a heap of cheap rags, threatening to rattle the teeth right out of his head. Tree limbs came slicing from the darkness, clawing at the wagon's sides, slashing at his face. One had snatched Shai's hat off, and now her hair whipped around her staring eyes, fixed on the rushing road, lips peeled back from her teeth as she yelled the most blood-curdling abuse at the horses. Temple dreaded to imagine the weight of wood, metal, and above all gold they were currently hurtling down a mountainside on top of. Any moment now the whole, surely tested beyond the limits of human engineering, would rip itself apart and the pair of them into the bargain. But dread was a fixture of Temple's life, and what else could he do now but cling to this bouncing engine of death, muscles burning from fingertips to armpits, stomach churning with drink and terror? He hardly knew whether eyes closed or eyes open was the more horrifying.
"Hold on!" Shai screamed at him.
"What the fuck do you think I'm..."
She dragged back on the brake lever, boots braced against the footboard, and her shoulders against the back of the seat, fibers starting from her neck with effort. The tires shrieked like the dead in hell, sparks showering up on both sides like fireworks at the Emperor's birthday. Shai hauled on the reins with her other hand, and the whole world began to turn, then to tip, two of the great wheels parting company with the flying ground. Time slowed. Temple screamed. Shai screamed. The wagon screamed. Trees off the side of the bend hurtled madly towards them, death in their midst. Then the wheels jolted down again, and Temple was almost flung over the footboard and among the horse's milling hooves, biting his tongue and choking on his own screech as he was tossed back into the seat. Shai let the brake off and snapped the reins.
"Might have taken that one a little too fast," she shouted in his ear.
The line between terror and exultation was ever a fine one, and Temple found all of a sudden he had broken through. He punched at the air and howled,
"Fuck you, Koska!"
into the night until his breath ran out and left him gasping.
"Feel better?" asked Shai. "I'm alive! I'm free! I'm rich!"
Surely there was a god, a benevolent, understanding, kindly grandfather of a god, and smiling down indulgently upon him even now. Sooner or later you have to do something, or you'll never do anything, Koska had said. Temple wondered if this was what the old man had in mind. It did not seem likely. He grabbed hold of Shai and half-hugged her and shouted in her ear,
"We did it!"
"You sure?"
she grunted, snapping the reins again.
"Didn't we do it? The easy part. Eh? They won't just be letting this go, will they?"
she called over the rushing wind as they picked up pace.
"Not the money, not the insult."
"They'll be coming after us," he muttered.
"That's the whole point of the exercise."
Temple cautiously stood to look behind them, wishing he was less drunk. Nothing but snow and dirt spraying up from the clattering back wheels and the trees to either side vanishing into the darkness.
"They've got no horses, though,"
his voice turning into a hopeful little whine at the end.
"Sweet, slowed them down, but they'll still be coming, and this contraption ain't the fastest."
Temple took another look back, wishing he was more drunk. The line between exultation and terror was ever a fine one, and he was rapidly crossing back over.
"Maybe we should stop the wagon, take two of the horses, leave the money, most of the money anyway. We need to give Lam and Savian time, remember?"
"Oh, yes, that."
The problem with courageous self-sacrifice was the self-sacrifice part. It had just never come naturally to him. The next jolt brought a wash of choking vomit to the back of Temple's mouth, and he tried to swallow it, choked, spluttered, and felt it burning all the way up his nose with a shiver. He looked up at the sky, stars vanished now, and shifting from black to iron grey as the dawn came on.
"Whoa!"
Another bend came blundering from the gloom, and Shai dragged the shrieking brakes on again. Temple could hear the cargo sliding and jingling behind them as the wagon bounded around the corner, the earnest desire of all that weight to plunge on straight and send them tumbling down the mountainside in ruin. As they clattered back onto the straight, there was an almighty cracking, and Shai reeled in her seat, one leg kicking, yelling out as she started to tumble off the wagon. Temple's hand snapped closed around her belt and hauled her back, the limb of the bow over her shoulder nearly taking his eye out as she fell against him, reins flapping. She held something up, the brake lever, and decidedly no longer attached.
"That's the end of that, then. What do we do?"
She tossed the length of wood over her shoulder, and it bounced away up the road behind them.
"Not stop?"
The wagon shot from the trees and onto the plateau. The first glimmer of dawn was spilling from the east, a bright shaving of sun showing over the hills, starting to turn the muddy sky a washed-out blue, The streaked clouds are washed up pink, setting the frozen snow that blanketed the flat country to glitter. Shai worked the reins hard and insulted the horses again, which felt a little unfair to Temple, until he remembered how much better insults had worked on him than encouragement. Their heads dipped and manes flew, and the wagon picked up still more speed, wheels spinning faster on the flat and faster yet, the snowy scrub whipping past, and the wind blasting at Temple's face and plucking at his cheeks and rushing in his cold nose. Far ahead he could see horses scattering across the plateau, Sweet and Crying Rock no doubt further off with most of the herd. No dragon's hoard to retire on, but they'd cash in a decent profit on a couple of hundred mounts. When it came to stock, people out here were more concerned with price than origin.
"Anyone following?"
called Shai, without taking her eyes off the road. Temple managed to pry his hand from the seat long enough to stand and look behind them. Just the jagged blackness of the trees, and a rapidly growing stretch of flat whiteness between them and the wagon.
"No!"
he shouted, confidence starting to leak back.
"No one! Wait!"
He saw movement, a rider.
"Oh, God!"
he muttered, confidence instantly draining. More of them.
"Oh, God! How many? 3! No! 5! No! 7!
They were still a few hundred strides behind, but they were gaining.
"Oh, God!"
he said again as he dropped back down into the shuddering seat.
"Now what's the plan? We're already off the end of the plan. I had a nasty feeling you'd say that. Take the reins!"
she shouted, thrusting them at him. He jerked his hands away.
"And do what? Can't you drive? Badly? I thought you'd done everything. Badly. Shall I stop and give you a fucking lesson? Drive!"
She pulled her knife from her belt and offered that to him as well.
"Or you could fight."
Temple swallowed. Then he took the reins.
"I'll drive."
Surely there was a god. A mean little trickster laughing his divine ass off at Temple's expense, and hardly for the first time. Shai wondered how much of her life she'd spent regretting her last decision. Too much, that was sure. Looked like today was going to plough the same old furrow. She dragged herself over the wooden parapet and onto the wagon's tar-painted roof, bucking under her feet like a mean bull trying to toss a rider. She lurched to the back, shrugged her bow off into her hand, clawed away her whipping hair, and squinted across the plateau.
"Oh, shit,"
she muttered. 7 riders, just like Temple said, and gaining ground. All they had to do was get ahead of the wagon, bring down a horse or two in the team, and that'd be that. They were out of range still, specially shooting from what might as well have been a raft in rapids. She wasn't bad with a bow, but she was no miracle worker either. Her eyes went to the hatch on the roof, and she tossed the bow down and slithered over to it on her hands and knees, drew her sword and jammed it into the hasp the padlock was on. Way too strong and heavy. The tar around the hinges was carelessly painted, though, the wood more than halfway rotten. She jammed the point of the sword into it, twisted, gouged, working out the fixings, digging at the other hinge.
"Are they still following?"
she heard Temple shriek.
"No!"
she forced through her gritted teeth as she wedged her sword under the hatch and hauled back on it.
"I've killed them all!" "Really?" "No, not fucking really!"
And she went skittering over on her ass as the hatch ripped from its hinges and flopped free. She flung the sword away, thoroughly bent, dragged the hatch open with her fingertips, started clambering down into the darkness. The wagon hit something and gave a crashing jolt, snatched the ladder from her hands, and flung her on her face. Light spilled in from above, through cracks around the shutters of the narrow windows. Heavy gratings down both sides, padlocked and stacked with chests and boxes and saddlebags, bouncing and thumping and jingling, treasure spilling free, gold gleaming, gems twinkling, coins sliding across the plank floor, 5 king's ransoms, and change left over for a palace or two. There were a couple of sacks under her, too, crunchy with money. She stood, bouncing from the gratings to either side as the wagon twitched left and right on its groaning springs, started dragging the nearest sack towards the bright line between the back doors. Heavy as all hell, but she'd hauled a lot of sacks in her time, and she wasn't about to let this one beat her. Shai had taken beatings enough, but she'd never enjoyed them. She fumbled the bolts free, cursing, sweat prickling her forehead, then, holding tight to the grate beside her, booted the doors wide. The wind whipped in, the bright white emptiness of the plateau opening up, the clattering blur of the wheels and the snow showering from them, the black shapes of the riders following, closer now. Much closer. She whipped her knife out and hacked the sack gaping open, dug her fist in and threw a handful of coins out the back, and another, and the other hand, and then both, flinging gold like she was sowing the seed on the farm. It came to her then how hard she'd fought as a bandit, and slaved as a farmer, and haggled as a trader, for a fraction of what she was flinging away with every movement. She jammed the next fistful down into her pocket, 'cause, well, why not die rich? Then she scooped more out with both hands, threw the empty bag away, and went back for seconds. The wagon hit a rut and tossed her in the air, smashed her head into the low ceiling, and sent her sprawling. Everything reeled for a moment. Then she staggered up and clawed the next sack towards the swinging, banging doors, growling curses at the wagon and the ceiling and her bleeding head. She braced herself against the grate and shoved the sack out with her boot, bursting open in the snow and showering gold across the empty plain. A couple of the riders had stopped, one already off his horse and on his hands and knees after the coins, dwindling quickly into the distance. But the others came on regardless, more determined than she'd hoped. That's hopes for you. She could almost see the face of the nearest mercenary bent low over his horse's dipping head. She left the doors banging and scrambled back up the ladder, dragged herself out onto the roof.
"Be still following?" shrieked Temple. "Yes! What are you doing? Have enough fucking lie down before they get here!"
The wagon was hurtling into broken land, the plateau folded with little streams, scattered with boulders and pillars of twisted rock. The road dropped down into a shallow valley, steep sides blurring past, wheels rattling harder than ever. Shai wiped blood from her forehead with the back of her hand, slithered across the shuddering roof to the back, scooping up the bow and drawing an arrow. She squatted there for a moment, breathing hard. Better to do it than live with the fear of it. Better to do it. She came up. The nearest rider wasn't 5 strides back from the swinging doors. He saw her, eyes going wide, yellow hair and a broad chin, and cheeks pinked from the wind. She thought she'd seen him writing a letter back in Beacon. He'd cried while he did it. She shot his horse in the chest. Its head went back, it caught one hoof with the other, and horse and rider went down together, tumbling over and over, straps and tackle flapping in a tangle, the others swerving around the wreckage as she ducked back down to get another arrow. Thought she could hear Temple muttering something.
"You praying? No! Better start!"
She came up again, and an arrow shuddered into the wood just beside her. A rider, black against the sky on the valley's edge, drawing level with them, horse's hooves a blur, standing in his stirrups with masterful skill, and already pulling back his string again.
"Shit!"
She dropped down, and the shaft flitted over her head and clicked into the parapet on the other side. A moment later, another joined it. She could hear the rest of the riders now shouting to each other just at the back of the wagon. She put her head up to peer over, and a shaft twitched into the wood, point showing between 2 planks not a hand's width from her face, made her duck again. She'd seen some ghosts damn good at shooting from horseback, but never as good as this. It was bloody unfair, that's what it was. But fair has never been an enforceable principle in a fight to the death. She knocked her shaft, took a breath, and stuck her bow up above the parapet. Right away an arrow flitted between the limb and the string, and up she came. She knew she was nowhere near as good with a bow as he was, but she didn't have to be. A horse is a pretty big target. Her shaft stuck to the flights in its ribs, and it lost its footing right off, fell sideways, rider flying from his saddle with a howl, his bow spinning up in the air, and the pair of them tumbling down the side of the valley.